Sermon for Kol Nidre, September the 27th, 2009, for the new year, 5770. It was an historic moment when Barack Obama, the still new President of the United States, mounted the podium at the United Nations last week and addressed the delegates from around the world. It was certainly not the first time a U.S. president spoke before the General Assembly. Franklin Delano Roosevelt had conceived the idea, though he didn't live to see the United Nations become a reality. But since then, countless American presidents delivered speeches in the large hall of that Manhattan building whose facade are the flags of virtually every nation in the world. What made Barack Obama's speech historic is that he broke with the recent past policy of his predecessor and announced that the United States no longer wishes to act alone. He enumerated the problems facing our world: global warming, depletion of natural resources, a global economy still in crisis, the proliferation of terrorism, horrific wars and continued genocide, the existence of extreme poverty, rampant disease in the poorest of countries, and the continued threat of the spread of nuclear armaments. But the president's theme again and again was that America will do its share and more, but it cannot solve the world's problems alone and will not even try. He quoted President Roosevelt by saying, "The structure of world peace, which was the founding goal of the United Nations, the structure of world peace cannot be the work of one man or one party or one nation. It cannot be the responsibility of large nations or of small nations. It must rest on the cooperative effort of the whole world." I'm not sure who gave a name to the president's speech, but it did get a title. It is called The Need for Engagement. My friends, I am not President Obama, nor am I, or was I ever, a speechwriter for the White House. Nor have I been asked to address the United Nations. But I too want to speak about the need for engagement. On this sacred night, when our tradition gives us the opportunity to focus on what's really important in life, what really gives meaning to our lives, when our tradition tries to direct our thoughts to the essential purpose of human beings on this planet, I too want to talk about the need for engagement. But what I want you and me to be engaged in is not international cooperation to resolve the world's problems. That's President Obama's job and all of the delegates who sit in that august body. What I want to do tonight is to focus on the need for engaging in life, to be engaged in living, truly living. Not existing, but living life. When I was growing up and being taught of all the rituals of Jewish tradition, one of the many I learned about was called Tfilat HaDerech, the prayer for the road. It is the prayer that is said before people take a journey. I knew of the prayer, but as a child and even a youngster, I rarely said it. Because who in Brooklyn went on a journey? Who left home, even for a short time? I remember saying it when I was 17 years old, on the way to the Catskill Mountains, where I was to work in the summer as a waiter. And I remember it most poignantly when I was 19 and took my very first trip to Israel. My father took me to Eastern Parkway and Kingston Avenue to the Lubavitcher Rebbe to get his blessing. My father was concerned about my safety, which was understandable. He had left Lithuania as a young man, and he knew what a danger it was to travel around the world. And so I understood that Tfilat HaDerech was my father's prayer and the Lubavitcher Rebbe's prayer that I should arrive safely to my destination and that I should return safely to my home as well. Later on, I said Tfilat HaDerech often. For later on, I began to travel. And I remember particularly saying Tfilat HaDerech on the many car trips that I took with my young family. We packed the children in the back of the Volvo, and we were on the East Coast. We drove all the way down to Atlanta, and I remember going across country to New Orleans, and we said Tfilat HaDerech. When I moved to California, I was living in Los Angeles. I remember the drive up to Vancouver and visiting Banff and stopping through Seattle on the way back. And we said Tfilat HaDerech. And then we went south. I remember the trip to San Diego and to Mexico. And we said Tfilat HaDerech. And I remember driving all the way up to San Francisco to see Fisherman's Wharf and the Golden Gate Bridge. And as the kids had piled into the car, we said Tfilat HaDerech. But the Tfilat HaDerech, the prayer for the road, was different than the one my parents had recited for me and the one that I learned in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, which I hardly ever left. The prayer I recited as a child was focused on the destination and the return. It was getting somewhere and getting back. And it was inspired by the trip that the patriarch Jacob took when he left his home with his mother and his father behind and made his way to Haran. And he prayed for God to be with him all the way to Haran and to bring him safely back home. But when I piled my kids in the car, we said a different kind of Tfilat HaDerech. After the traditional words, but before we started the engine, I would turn to the family and say, what do we want to get out of this trip? What are each of our hopes and our goals for the next week? Or if it was longer, for 2 weeks, or even for 3 weeks. And it didn't take long before my kids caught on that the right answers were, we want to get closer as a family. We want to see things that we've never seen before. Or we want to have fun. We want to camp out. We want to eat in different places and have different foods. And what they were doing, what I was doing with that new form of Tfilat HaDerech, was focusing not on the destination, but upon the voyage. It was not where we were going, but the trip along the way. On Kol Nidre night, we need to focus on the voyage called life. We need to use these 25 hours of Yom Kippur that were granted to train ourselves to look not at the destination, but upon the journey. Not to focus upon what we need to get through the long trip, namely our tzaras and our problems and our challenges, That's Barack Obama's sermon. Ours is, what do we need to do to live? So that the days and the months and the years don't pass us by till we wake up one day worrying that we didn't buy a plot in the eternal home or home of peace or in another cemetery in Colma. The psalmist tries to teach us to number our days so that we can get us a heart of wisdom. What does it mean to number our days? It means to learn how to make our days count. It's not the years, but the days. Not the destination, but the journey. I think that too often, too many of us are not really engaged in life. We're here, we function, we get up, we get dressed, we go to work, we go to the store, we go to shul, we go to the movies, we eat and sleep and talk and walk. But too often we're just going through the motions of life. We are not engaged in life. To be engaged in life means to be taking an active part, to direct our actions and our behaviors towards making of our life a miracle. And making of our days a difference in this world. To be something in this universe. To feel blessed that we were born into it. To be engaged in life means to be an active participant. And the reward for being such a participant is incredible. The reward for being engaged in life is to be alive, not merely exist, not to be a blur of little or no significance, but to be alive, fully alive. You may think, what's the chiddush? What's new about this? But so many of us miss the point until life is virtually over. I'm going to lighten up the spirit of Yom Kippur by telling you this cute little story. Not about a Jew, but a Catholic. The story is told that when the Pope died, he went immediately to heaven, and there he met St. Peter at the pearly gates. And St. Peter said to him, "Your Highness, we have been waiting for you to come here because you have been such a great human being, such a loyal and such a faithful Pope. And we are prepared to grant you any wish you desire, whatever it is that your heart wishes, it will be granted." And the Pope said, in a remarkably Polish accent, "All my life, I have wanted to see the original documents of the early church fathers. To see them, to even hold them in my hand, would be the greatest pleasure I can imagine." And no sooner had the Pope finished expressing his request that angels carried him on their wings into the heavenly library, lowered him onto a gold throne before a glass table, and instantly all of the documents of the early church fathers, all the scrolls were placed on the table, and he was left alone to fulfill his heart's desire. Hours went by, and all of a sudden, the angels heard shrieking from the library. They ran to see what was wrong, and they said to the Pope, "Here, this is your wish granted. The documents of the early church fathers, their own script and their own handwriting. What is wrong?" And the Pope said, It says here, celebrate, not celibate. Sometimes, my friends, we go through our whole lives missing the point, doing it wrong, not being fully alive, not knowing how to make of our lives a miracle. I think that the first thing we have to remember, if we're going to be engaged in life, is to appreciate that we are such a miracle. It is told of the first Lubavitcher Rebbe that the Russian government or its agents imprisoned him in prison for obviously false charges. And he found himself in what can only be called a dungeon. And outside his cell was the jailer, Ivan, who sat there day after day looking at the rabbi. The rabbi noticed that his look was a strange one. And so one day he said to this man that was separated from him only by those bars, "You want to ask me something. What is it that you have on your mind?" And the jailer said, "I know you are considered a man of God, deeply religious, and you hold sacred the Bible. When I was young, I studied the Bible. But I realized it's all foolishness. Let me give you an example. In that story of Adam and Eve, when they sin against God, they run and hide. And God comes into the garden and he says to them, 'Where are you?' What kind of a God is that, that can't see behind a tree, that can't look through a bush, that he can't find this couple that he created? This is the God that you worshipped, who has to ask, 'Where are you?'" And Lubavitcher Rebbe said, "Ivan, God wasn't asking the question of Adam and Eve. He was asking the question of you. The word he asked was, 'Ayeka, where are you?'" Ivan the jailer, where are you? Where are you? Can you be contented with a life here in this dungeon? You think you're a jailer, but you're a prisoner just like me, living your life in this darkness. Ayeka, where are you, Ivan? Where are you?" And with that, the Rebbe was talking to all of us. To be engaged with life, we have to ask ourselves, "Ayeka, where are we? Where are we in our lives? What are we doing with our lives? In what way are we trying to make sense of what it means to have been born into existence? Are we living our lives as if we are a miracle? Do we see in these days an opportunity to paint a masterpiece? Or do we just through, day by day, just trudge through, waiting until it's over, and living in darkness?" The second lesson we have to learn is that to be engaged in life, we have to be in relationship. We cannot live alone. We need to be in relationship with others. Whether it's husband or wife, whether it's parents with children, whether it's friends with neighbors, brothers or sisters. We need to be in relationship with other people. We need to make of each day the experience of love. We need to feel bound up in some significant way with other human beings. That's the essence of the story of Adam and Eve. Before God went looking for them and asking them where they are, the Torah tells us that after Adam was created and could not find an appropriate partner in life, God put him to sleep and pulled out a rib from his side, and from that rib created woman. It sounds like a Baba Maisa, like a child's myth. But there is such deep wisdom in that story. And you can find that wisdom if you just read till the end. The Torah says when the man awoke, he said, "This one at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Therefore, a man should leave his father and mother and cling unto his partner, and they shall become one." The Kabbalistic mystics said that before a human being is born, there was a soul up in heaven that is divided in two. And that soul, divided in those two halves, is placed in the bodies of two infants about to be born. And the responsibility as they grow is to find the other half to their soul. And when they do and unite, they finally become one. They become whole. What the Kabbalists and the Torah is trying to tell us is that we are not whole when we are alone. That it's more than a situation of loneliness. That there's a dimension of life that we can only feel when we give love. When we feel connected. When we feel bound up with other people, with one other person or more than one other person. But that a life lived without being loved and without giving love is not engagement in life. It's existing, but it's missing the incredible power that makes life truly worthwhile. And then there was the third step in being engaged in life. After we come to appreciate ourselves as a miracle, and after we realize how our lives are enriched when we don't remain alone, but bond with others, the time has come for us to make a difference in this world by enhancing and enriching the lives of those who are the downtrodden, the oppressed, the poor. I want to tell you a story that shows how one person can change the world. There was a man from Iowa, one man, who saved more lives than any other person in human history. He is credited with saving as many as 1 billion lives. Not million, but 1 billion lives. Can you believe that? And what's equally amazing is that hardly anyone knows his name. It's not Warren Buffett or those young kids who founded Google and Microsoft and Yahoo. Nor is it Albert Einstein or Mother Teresa. His name was Norman Borlaug. And I read his obituary in the paper barely 2 weeks ago. Until then, I never heard of him either. Norman Borlaug was born on a farm in Iowa in 1914 and left home during the Great Depression. But he maintained an interest in farming and specifically in plant biology. And after gaining a university education, he went to work for DuPont. It didn't last all that long because the Rockefeller Foundation got a hold of him and sent him to Mexico. You see, what they saw was that science had lowered infant mortality and at the same time increased longevity. And now the world's population was mushrooming. What Norman Borlaug realized was that with the increase in population, there simply wasn't enough food for all the people in this world. And particularly in Mexico, which was a very poor country. And so he dedicated his life to finding a way to increase wheat production. And he developed the ability by making the basic corn plant shorter and more stout that it can increase its production 4 times from what it was previously. He did that with wheat and corn. And so that poor subsistence farmers for the first time had enough to eat. His method was used to triple the production of rice and many other vegetables. And he was given the Nobel Peace Prize and credited with being the father of the Green Revolution. Norman Borlaug, one man hardly known, he saved 1 billion people by the time he died at the age of 95. And who knows how many other people will continue to be saved because of what this one man did. All right, you say. I'm not a Moses, and I'm not a Norman Borlaug. What's expected of me? Well, I'll tell you. The Zivtz Dukkha Fund, which was started by my rabbinical classmate, Danny Siegel, may he live as 120 and more, began to find mitzvah people, people who were doing something on a small scale, but changing the lives and helping those who were less fortunate. And the Zivtz Dukkha Fund itself began to grow and collected more money than you would ever think possible, and began to spread it out to those individuals who were making a difference in other people's lives. That included a Rebbetzin in Israel by the name of Bracha Kapach, who was helping poor brides get married off. And Ruth Schlossman, who was a massage therapist, began to develop healing techniques and massage therapy for people who survived terror attacks. And Karen Green, who had made Aliyah to Israel, started something called Crossroads, which is saving the lives of English-speaking children who were living on the streets in Jerusalem. And Dr. Menachem Gottesman started a school which became known as the Last Chance Saloon for kids for high school. Libby Reichman took the idea of big brothers and big sisters to Israel. And she started a program there. And Ziv Berger, not even a dentist, established a free dental clinic for the neediest children in Israel. Yoav Dorkum helps new immigrants feel at home. Alice Jonah works specifically with Russian immigrants. There are people working with Ethiopian immigrants. and a woman named Phyllis Heimowitz, who also had made Aliyah to Israel, established an organization that no one thought of at all. She realized that when Israeli soldiers fell in battle, the government was deeply concerned about its family. But no one was thinking about the girlfriends they left behind. And she started an organization that would provide emotional support for those girls so they could begin to piece their lives back together when no one was paying attention to them. There are people like Shmuel Monk and Yoram Mordechai who work with rehabilitating people who have mental illness and depression. And Joseph Gittler started Israel's food recycling program. And Asher Elias started training Ethiopian immigrants for high-tech life in Israel. There are people working to see that those in wheelchairs are living independently, that the elderly have connections with telephones, and that children who have no homes can be raised in a loving and warm environment. These are things that simple people are doing, not plant biologists and scientists who get the Nobel Peace Prize, but people like you and me who are doing a mitzvah each and every day. I want to tell you something personal. I did not want to spend the last 2 weeks or so working on my Yom Kippur sermons. I know all my colleagues do. The J Weekly said so. It's what's expected of us. And a rabbi who doesn't deliver a sermon on Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur or Kol Nidre night and at Yizkor the next day won't hold the pulpit for very long. It's expected of us, and it's unquestioned. But that's not how I wanted to spend my time this year. I'll tell you what I really wanted to do instead. I wanted to call Jean Goldman. A woman is 93 years old, whose life was tied up with Ner Tamid for decades, whose husband was a shamus here, but when she couldn't walk up the stairs in her sunset house, she sold it and she moved near her son in Massachusetts. I know that Jean misses us terribly, so I wanted to call her and schmooze with her. I heard she's not so well, and I knew that a telephone call from me would make her feel much better. I wanted to visit Ben Tarrant. Ben joined Ner Tamid when he was just about 90 years old. He had been coming here for 30 years and nobody ever asked him to be a member, so he just came on High Holy Days. His wife Ethel was living in the Jewish home with Alzheimer's disease, if you call that living. Ben drove to the home every single day until he joined Ner Tamid, 7 days a week. But when he came here, he decided he can take off one day from his devoted responsibilities and come to shul. And when Ethel died, Ben said Kaddish at our minyan and participated in virtually everything that happens in our synagogue. Now, Ben himself lives in the Jewish home. And I know how much his eyes light up when I come over for lunch. So I wanted to visit Ben Tarrant. And I wanted to drive down the peninsula and spend some time with George Mazels. George lives off 92 on Alameda de las Pulgas. It's pretty far from here. George lives across the street from a large Reformed temple, but he'll never leave Ner Tamid. This is the place where the Yard Site Board has a memorial plaque for both his parents, for his wife, and his two brothers. Ner Tamid is a shul, but George doesn't make it out of his home very often anymore. He was on my list to visit on the second night of Rosh Hashanah so that he wouldn't miss hearing the shofar. But by the time Ben Conan and Libyan and I finished our circuit for people who live in the city, it was 8 o'clock at night, and we no longer had the time or the energy to drive down to San Mateo and see George Mazels. So I wanted to visit him before Yom Kippur, but I couldn't. Too much to do. Well, my friends, when I give a sermon, I'm not really talking to you. I'm talking to myself. And so, I made sure that I got through to Gene Goldman. It took 4 calls, but finally I heard her voice. And she was so thrilled to hear from me. And she sent so many regards to so many people here in the shul and wanted everybody to know how much she misses coming to Neo Tamid. This is her home, she said. That's my family. And one day, I'll come back because my plot is there. And I got to Ben Tarrant also. And his eyes do light up. And we got to talk about the Russian woman who lives not too far from his room, who shared her entire story of life in the former Soviet Union, when it was the Soviet Union. And I never got to George Maisel's, but that second day of Rosh Hashanah, when I realized that I wouldn't make it, I called David Volansky, who was down in the peninsula with friends, and he had his shofar. And I gave him George's address and George's telephone number. And he stopped by on his way back home, and he stayed for hours, listening to George tell him the stories of what it was like to grow up in San Francisco, and what the streets that David Volansky lives on now, what they were like when they were sand dunes. And the stories abounded, and it was a bond. My friends, there is so much I want to do, so much I hope you want to do. Because when we do for others, we engage ourselves in life. I told you a story that I'm going to use to close my sermon tonight. I told it to you when it happened a number of years ago, before my mother, Olive Shalom, passed away. When I used to go to Florida every month, and I would spend time with her and visit, take her to the store to see her sister, to hang out with my kids. I used to go down every morning to the swimming pool that was a part of her 15, 18, 21-story building. I don't remember how tall it was. A lot of apartments. And right outside the lobby was the swimming pool, and I used to go there for laps. One morning, I got out of the pool after my swim, and as I was about to make my way to the lobby, I realized that I had left the key upstairs, the security key that allows one to get from the outside to the inside of the building. I looked around and there was no one else by the pool except one very elderly man who was sitting in one of those folding chairs, you know, with the green and white plastic stretched over the warp and woof of those aluminum tube chairs. And his head was down to his chin against his chest. He was fast asleep. I didn't want to wake him, of course, so I looked through the glass doors into the lobby, hoping that I would find someone to whom I could give a signal, come and open the door, but no one was there. I knocked on the glass, hoping to catch the attention of the doorman in the security part of the building, but none of them heard me. And finally I realized that if I stayed down much longer, I'd be committing a terrible sin. And that was, I would be making my mother worry. And so, with a great deal of hesitation, I walked over to that man who was sleeping, and I tapped him on the shoulder. When he raised his head and he opened his eyes, I said to him, "I'm so sorry to trouble you, but I forgot the key that would get me back in the building. Could you let me in?" And he said, "Certainly." And with his hands on the two arms of the chair, he raised himself up, took his cane, and began walking to the section of the swimming pool where there was the door into the lobby. I felt so bad that I had roused him from his nap and said to him, "Please, please forgive me for disturbing you so. I feel so bad that I forgot my key and I couldn't find anybody else to let me in." And before he turned the key that would open that automatic door, he looked at me and he said, "Young man, stop apologizing. We are put on this earth to help each other." My friends, we are put on this earth to help each other. That is how we engage with life. We may not be able to solve all of the world's great problems. We'll leave that to President Barack Obama and all of those delegates at the United Nations. But what we can do is help one human being at a time. We can remember that our lives are a miracle and not take ourselves for granted. We can connect with another human being and find love and be loved. And we can make a difference in other people's lives. For that's what it means to be alive. May we have on this Yom Kippur not an easy fast, but a meaningful one, so that we are engaged in life. Amen.